Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, and you're listening to Southern Fried True Crime. Today's episode is also brought to you by Studio Sweden, the maker of premium wireless headphones with sound studio quality and a gorgeous design. I got a pair of the over-the-ear Regents, which I've used in production and fallen in love with. Go to studiosweden.com and use code SOUTHERNFRIED for a 15% discount and free shipping all over the world. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for all listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Episode 9, my first case of the new year. I want to thank all of you for listening, as well as for your patience over the holiday break, which was a little longer than I had planned due to laryngitis. I'm so glad to be back, and I'm very grateful that you're listening. Imagine at the age of 16 being sex trafficked by a pimp named Cutthroat. After days of being repeatedly drugged and raped by different men, you were purchased by a 43-year-old child predator who took you to his home to use you for sex. You ended up finding enough courage to fight back and shoot and kill him. You're arrested as a result, tried and convicted as an adult, and sentenced to life in prison. This is the story of Centoya Brown. She will be eligible for parole when she is 69 years old. Those are the words of pop star Rihanna in an Instagram post this past November that went viral and was shared by other celebrities like LeBron James, Snoop Dogg, and Kim Kardashian. It's unclear what prompted Rihanna to speak out recently, but Centoya was featured in a documentary on PBS in 2011 called Me Facing Life, Centoya's Story. I was able to find it on YouTube, and it is an unflinching look at her story. Frustrating, sad, but also hopeful and redemptive. Though Centoya Brown has been in the Tennessee prison for women in Nashville for over a decade, Rihanna's post has caused a fury of new interest and even spurred a petition to urge Governor Bill Haslam to grant Centoya clemency. At this recording, the petition has over 472,000 signatures. Of course, a story like this is never black and white. Depending on your perspective, it could be shockingly worse or depressingly mundane. I'll let you be the judge. At around 11 o'clock on Friday night, August 5th, 2004, at the Sonic on Murfreesboro Pike in Nashville, Tennessee, a car hop saw a white Ford pickup truck drive by and waved it down. 43-year-old real estate agent Johnny Allen pulled over and leaned out the window grinning at the young woman. She realized quickly he had the wrong impression and told him his headlights were off. He just replied, "I'm sorry," and drove off. He returned about 15 minutes later, and this time he had a teenage girl in the passenger seat. The girl, though scantily dressed, was obviously underage. The car hop took their order. Allen bought a chicken sandwich, fries, and a Coke for the girl. And when she jokingly said, "That will be $99, he said, "That's kinda expensive." She replied, "Don't you think she's worth it?" With that question, Johnny Allen replied, "I don't know. We'll see." The car hop had assumed by the age difference that the girl was a niece or a daughter, and later testified how uncomfortable his comment had made her. Sometime around 6 p.m. the next day, a 911 dispatcher received a call with what sounded like a little girl trying to imitate a man's voice. She just said 2728 Mossdale Drive. When the dispatcher asked her what was going on over there, the caller replied, "Homicide," and hung up. Metro officers entered Johnny Allen's home through the garage and found him in the bedroom. He was lying on his right side at the very edge of the bed, facing the wall. His hands were curled under his face and his fingers intertwined. The bullet that ended his life had gone through the back of his head and come out the front. Blood stained the mattress and box springs and was pooled on the floor. The force of the bullet had blasted his toupee into the mess. Working from a tip, police had their suspect by 3 a.m. the next morning and knocked on a door at the InTown Suites on Murfreesboro Pike. A pimp, known as Cutthroat, opened the door and was quickly pinned to the ground. 16-year-old Centoya Brown ran from the room in just a bra and panties, screaming, "Cut had nothing to do with it. I'll tell y'all everything." And she did. In a small interrogation room downtown, cold, under the influence, slurring, and at times hardly able to keep her eyes open, Centoya Brown did talk. Metro detectives Charles Robinson and Derry Baltimore used a time-worn and accepted technique used to deceive suspects, promising Centoya that they would, quote, help her with the DA if she would just talk to them and sign the Miranda waiver. On the video of the confession, Centoya's confusion is evident on her face and in what she says as they read her the Miranda rights. She said, "You're not sitting here and you're not promising me anything as far as helping me if I talk, but you just promised me that." Detective Robinson faltered a bit and said that before the video started, he had only assured her that he would tell the district attorney that she had been cooperative. Centoya now read the Miranda rights back to the detectives, but skipped a section about promises. A couple of minutes later, she knocked over her soft drink onto the original Miranda waiver papers. But she soon signed a new one, and then launched into her confession, seeming more like she was just ready to get it over with. Now, anyone who watches an episode of Law and Order knows that cops are allowed plenty of leeway with the truth when interrogating a witness. It's not uncommon for them to use a phrase like, "Sure, we'll talk to the DA for you," in hopes that a suspect will start talking. Coerced confessions have obviously been around as long as our court system has. But the coerced confession of minors have really come into the public's consciousness in recent decades, particularly starting with the Central Park Five, who were the young men who falsely confessed to gang rape in the Central Park jogger case. They spent 12 years behind bars until a serial rapist in prison confessed. Not only was his DNA a match, he knew details only the attacker could have known. More recently, Brandon Dassey, the nephew of Stephen Avery, the murderer of Teresa Halbeck, featured in the documentary Making a Murderer, has been in the news. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals recently overruled a judge's decision that the confession Dassey gave was to be thrown out and he would be given a new trial. There were three dissenting judges who wrote that the decision was, quote, a profound miscarriage of justice. What occurred here was the interrogation of an intellectually impaired juvenile, Judge Elena Rovner wrote. Dassey was subjected to myriad psychologically coercive techniques, but the state court did not review his interrogation with the special care required by Supreme Court precedent. His confession was not voluntary, and his conviction should not stand. And yet an impaired teenager has been sentenced to life in prison. Dassey's lawyers plan to appeal to the Supreme Court. They released a statement saying, "Today's ruling contravenes a fundamental and time-honored position of the United States Supreme Court. Interrogation tactics that may not be coercive when applied to adults are coercive when applied to children and the mentally impaired. Indeed, when such tactics are applied to vulnerable populations, the risk of a false confession grows intolerably. I mention these two cases because I think they are some of the most famous cases of coerced confessions by minors. However, what they don't share in common with Centoya's case is that she did actually kill Johnny Allen. The Central Park Five were innocent. Brendan Dassey's fate has yet to be decided, but he does have a better chance with the Supreme Court. I personally do not believe he took part in Halbeck's murder, but that he was forced to help his uncle clean it up. And then he was coerced into a false confession. My point is, Centoya's confession may have been true, but were the tactics leading up to it fair for a minor? Should they be held to the same standard? I struggle with our country's treatment of minors all the time. They can be tried and convicted as adults. Once 18, they can vote and go to war to die for their country. But they still can't drink until age 21. We have arbitrary and often contradictory standards in our country, and they sometimes vary state to state as well. The key problem with juvenile offenders is their background and/or home life, if there even is a home life. Centoya Brown definitely got a very rocky start in life, and also has a troublesome family history with mental illness. Let's go back to the beginning and see how she wound up on Murfreesboro Pike that night, getting into Johnny Allen's car. In 1987, Ellinette Brown was a schoolteacher married to an Army infantryman named Thomas Brown, who was often deployed overseas. She had a son named John Harlston from a previous marriage and a daughter with Thomas named Missy. Her home was a haven for neighborhood teens. Ellinette, a trim and attractive black woman, was warm and easy to talk to. It's not hard to see why teenagers were drawn to her. A 16-year-old white girl named Georgina Mitchell was one of the kids that hung out a lot. She wore baggy football jerseys and hoodies like most teens in the late 80s. But the fashion of the times was also good for hiding problems. And Georgina, known as Gina, had a big one. She had moved to Clarksville, Tennessee from Georgia to live with her sister after her mother told her she couldn't come back home until she was rid of the black baby in her belly. Gina never went home. She stayed with her sister, and when she wasn't hanging out at Ellinette's house, she was draining a fifth of liquor daily as she sold her body for money to get by. And even though Gina found Ellinette easy to talk to, she didn't tell her about the prostitution or her drinking, much less the baby she was expecting. On January 29, 1988, Ellinette's son John called and asked if she would go with him to see Gina in the hospital. Ellinette was alarmed and asked if she'd been in an accident. He said no, she was having a baby. And by the time they got to the hospital, Gina was already holding her baby daughter she'd named Centoya. There was no father with her, nor one on the birth certificate. Centoya was given her mother's last name, Mitchell. Gina said the father could have been several different men, but showed no interest in finding who it was. She disappeared with Centoya as soon as she was released from the hospital. 6 months later, Gina showed up on Ellinette's doorstep with Centoya in her arms, begging her to look after the baby for a while. Ellinette agreed, and as weeks turned into months, she fell in love with Centoya and treated her as her own daughter. It wasn't easy. Because she wasn't Centoya's legal guardian, she couldn't put her in daycare. And she had to work, so she left her with an elderly neighbor that she trusted. She did eventually apply for and gain guardianship over Centoya, and they settled into a simple and somewhat stable family life. But about a year later, Gina reappeared in Clarksville. She called Ellinette and told her to get Centoya ready. Ellinette immediately called her son John, who told her vehemently, "Do not give her that girl." John had stayed in touch with Gina over the last year and knew she was working as a prostitute out of a motel on Trinity Lane in Nashville. She was strung out on crack and had been in and out of jail. So when Ellinette left for work that day, she told Thomas, who was on leave, not to let Centoya out of his sight. That afternoon, Thomas called her panic-stricken. He said that Gina came by and had begged him repeatedly just to let her take Centoya shopping, and he'd finally relented. But they'd been gone for hours, and now she wasn't answering her phone. Ellinette went straight to the Clarksville police, who just told her Gina would turn up, probably in jail, but she would turn up. This was before Amber Alerts. And since the child was with her birth mother, the police weren't that inclined to call it an abduction and investigate it as such. Ellinette was frantic with worry. She lost weight until she was painfully thin and had trouble sleeping. Finally, Gina's sister, who was a neighbor, came to her. She knew where Gina was, and she also knew she was strung out and couldn't care for Centoya. Turns out, Gina had gone back to Georgia. She was living in public housing at a place called the Elizabeth Canty Homes, one of the worst crime-ridden projects in Columbus, Georgia. Elinette immediately reached the building manager, who knew the name Gina Mitchell immediately. He told her Gina had been in and out of jail numerous times for drugs and prostitution. She also had split again and left Centoya with an elderly couple. Elinette drove 7 hours through the night to get there. Once she got there, Centoya was not with the elderly couple. Elinette went to the Columbus police, who were about as helpful as the Clarksville police were, though they did let her know Gina was back in jail. Finally, the same building manager, a kind soul, called around until he found out where Gina had been staying. Sure enough, she'd been staying with another couple in the projects. They said to give them 30 minutes to get Centoya dressed and ready, and then Elinette could come and get her. Centoya had been gone for 6 months. Elinette was beside herself thinking of what Centoya had been exposed to and what abuses she may have suffered. She rang the bell, and as she told the woman who answered who she was, to her astonishment, she heard little feet running to the door. The now 2-year-old Centoya clung to Elinette's neck like she would never let go, and in between her sobs, she asked her guardian why she had left her. When Elinette could finally answer, she told her she'd never do such a thing and she had come to take her baby home. At this time, I'm going to take a short break to hear a word from our sponsors. Today's episode is also brought to you by Studio Sweden, the maker of premium wireless headphones with sound studio quality and a gorgeous design. I got a pair of over-the-ear Regents, which I've used in production and fallen in love with. Go to studiosweden.com and use code SOUTHERNFRIED for a 15% discount and free shipping all over the world. So Elinette was finally able to bring Centoya home, but it was a very different little girl that came back. She clung to Elinette fiercely, as if she were afraid of losing her mother again. And she was legally her mother now, formally adopting Centoya and making her a Brown. From then on, even into Centoya's adult years, she called Elinette Mommy. But she also came home to a very different household. Thomas was deployed to Saudi Arabia for 13 months right when she got back, and Elinette's 2 other children were grown and had moved out. Centoya had trouble relating to other children and tried to always stay by Elinette's side, even when company was over. She had to be told to play with other children, and she knew she was adopted from the time she was old enough to understand. Even though they tried, Centoya, with her lighter skin, always felt like an outsider. Well, Elinette and her other children tried. Centoya's adoptive father, Thomas, was a mean drunk, and she was often his target. He told Centoya that she would wind up a drug-addicted prostitute just like her mother. Elinette had finally had enough of his behavior and decided it was time for Thomas to get sober. He reacted by throwing a lamp at her and strangling her for a couple of terrifying moments. Centoya saw this. She also watched the next day as her adopted brother John, who had found out about the incident, came in the house and started strangling Thomas. Elinette was away at church, so it was 9-year-old Centoya who called 911. In Centoya's documentary, Elinette reveals that her relationship to her adoptive father never recovered after this incident. She also said this was the age when Centoya really began acting out. She started drinking, sneaking sips at adult parties, stealing from her mother's liquor cabinet, anything to numb herself. It also happens to be around the time that Centoya made a discovery that hurt. And Elinette had not meant to hurt her, she meant to protect her. Centoya often daydreamed about her real mother, but Elinette never encouraged her to hope for any real reunion. But for all those years, Georgina Mitchell had been writing to her daughter. She often called when she was out of jail, promising to come visit, but she never followed through. So Elinette, in an effort to shield Centoya from feeling rejected, hid the letters. It isn't difficult to understand her reasoning, not at all. But imagine being 10-year-old Centoya and coming across a stash of letters from your real mother, A mother you'd been dreaming of for years. Letters full of affection and love and beautiful drawings, as Gina had a natural talent as an artist. Centoya felt betrayed and angry. All these years, she assumed her biological mother didn't care, didn't write, and didn't check in on her. Now she had letters dating back to her infancy proving her mother did care. Finding these letters was a major catalyst in Centoya's life. She grew distant from Elinette, no longer mommy's girl, and started acting out even more in school. Centoya was a gifted student, even taking the ACT college entrance exams while still in the seventh grade. She was later tested and found to have an IQ of 127. But she was ostracized by her peers for this. Being too smart wasn't exactly cool. And again, she felt like she didn't fit. She was teased for her light skin by black schoolmates, but of course, she wasn't accepted by her white schoolmates either. She was lonely, and she was angry, and that is never a good combination in a teenage girl, and even worse for someone with Centoya's background. She would later be diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome and also fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And while it seems contradictory because Centoya was such a good student, these disorders impair development and learning. In Centoya's case, it had more to do with her understanding of relationships and the forming of healthy attachments, and especially in evaluating other people and situations. This stunted way of understanding other people and their motivations would play into the crime that ultimately changed her life. But even while still in grade school, she was constantly cussing teachers and getting into fights. She was smoking pot, drinking, and skipping school. By the age of 12, she was picked up for theft. It was jewelry belonging to the mother of one of her friends, and it was worth about $2,000. This landed her in the district's alternative school for at-risk kids. It was noted during psychological evaluations at the school that Centoya was often disconnected from reality. She spoke in a sing-song voice and also threatened to kill her adopted father. For acting out against staff members, she was given Thorazine and other medications. But she also told the staff of abuses she suffered at the hands of her adoptive father. She not only told about the verbal abuse and occasional slaps and even punches, she accused Thomas Brown of rape. She later recanted the statement, saying she was just angry with him at the time, but Elinette Brown filed for divorce almost immediately after this and was never able to truly dismiss the possibility that it did happen. The rape was not investigated at the time, and it seems the counselors did not take her seriously, but Elinette was not taking chances. He was an abusive alcoholic, and it's hard to understand why Elinette stayed with him as long as she did. But it's also hard to fault Elinette for this, because she was obviously a victim herself. But once there was even a hint at sexual abuse, she immediately took action. Centoya wound up violating her probation by assaulting a teacher. She also pulled a fire alarm at a juvenile detention center while trying to escape. She wound up in Woodland Hills Youth Development Center in Nashville, which is basically considered the end of the line. More prison than school, with razor wire surrounding the buildings. Centoya was involved in more than 20 assaults while at Woodland Hills. When she was 14 years old, she was placed on a cocktail of psychotropic drugs for depression and anxiety, and was also entered in a program for drug and alcohol abuse. One counselor noted that she had little self-worth and expected the worst in others, always expecting them to betray her or fail her in some way. But her own behavior often led to what she would see as being let down by those she trusted, like with what happened with Elinette. Aside from the incident with the letters, Elinette had kept her divorce from Thomas a secret from Centoya while she was in the juvenile detention center. Once again, in her mind, she felt she was doing the right thing. She still wasn't sure that Thomas didn't sexually abuse Centoya, and because Centoya now denied it happened, she didn't feel comfortable telling her the truth. So Santoya did not find out about the divorce until she was released in April 2003 at the age of 15. She again returned home to yet another upheaval in her family situation. Elinette had a new boyfriend named Frank, whom Santoya hated on sight. According to Elinette, she did everything she could to run him off. With that not working, she fell back into skipping school, getting lost in drugs and alcohol, and again distancing herself from her adoptive mother. They were now fighting all the time, and Santoya soon started staying with her adopted sister Missy, caring for her small nephew. But of course, she was not reliable, so the situation was not stable either. She bounced between the households as well as friends' homes. In December of 2003, she was supposed to be waiting for Missy to help decorate the Christmas tree. She got tired of waiting for Missy to get off work, so she decorated the entire house and tree herself, packed a bag, and took off for Nashville with a friend. She was running away and looking for a new start. By age 16, she was living with an older woman named Shakosha, a woman who took in runaway kids and tried to help them out. But Santoya's downward spiral worsened. She smoked blunts, popped ecstasy pills, and snuck into nightclubs, dancing the night away. She began relationships with several different older men who took advantage of her. Then, according to Santoya, she started selling crack for a dealer she knew who was locked up and needed help. When he got out, he asked her to take a road trip to Florida on a cocaine run. She met him at a motel where he gave her a vodka drink. The drink was drugged. She later said she didn't know how many days he kept her in the motel room, raping her repeatedly. She finally got out of the room and called Shakosha, who came and got her. Despite Shakosha's efforts, it wasn't the end of Santoya's abuse at the hands of men. She says she was raped twice more before she met the pimp named Cutthroat, the pimp who would forever change the course of her life. Cutthroat deployed a familiar tactic, belittling Santoya and making her feel worthless. He called her a slut and a whore, but he also said she shouldn't feel bad about it and she should just try to be the best whore she could be. With Cut, she snorted her first line of cocaine. Cut's real name was Garion McGlothen, and he was 24 years old. She would later say that their sex was, quote, mostly unforced. He quickly got her addicted to cocaine. She lost weight and started looking haggard and older than her 16 years. She said that Cut often held a gun to her head, threatening her as he had sex with her, and that once he choked her into unconsciousness. It didn't take long for him to start pimping her out. He had been grooming her since he met her. During this time, she did call Elinette once, from a motel in Chattanooga. Elinette begged her daughter to let her come and get her, but Santoya told her not to worry, that she would get away soon and come home. But she didn't. She stayed with Cut, and what she didn't know is that he had been involved in a burglary where a club owner named Rachel Browning had been shot and paralyzed from the neck down. He had held on to the gun and decided to lay low. This would be the gun Santoya would later use. He checked himself and Santoya into the in-town suites on Murfreesboro Pike. The room had a double bed and a hot plate. And to pay for this and their coke habit, he set Santoya up on the pike to work near the hotel. It's a well-known place for prostitution. Santoya said sometimes she would just grab the John's money and run, but when she did perform sexual acts, she claimed she charged $250, of which she would split with Cut. We are now up to August of 2004. On Friday night, the 5th of August, is when Cut sent her out and she met Johnny Allen at the Sonic, with Cut's gun tucked away in her purse. Allen insisted on taking her back to his home on Mossdale Drive off Bell Road. Allen was 43 years old and had been divorced since 1999. Santoya found his home unusual for a bachelor, daintily decorated with doilies on every table and girly figurines. As he showed her around, he showed off an extensive gun collection. He claimed to be an expert marksman, army-trained, and his collection was impressive and intimidating. He had a chrome pistol, a .22 caliber rifle, and a double-barrel shotgun. After they sat and watched TV as Centoya ate, Alan tried a few times to kiss her. Centoya testified that she rebuffed his advances and claimed she was tired. He then led her to the master bedroom where he undressed as they slipped into the bed. Centoya maintains that she pretended to go to sleep, hoping he would give up on sex with her. But he kept getting up and walking back and forth to the spare bedroom. He would then come back and stand over her staring. She was growing more and more scared. She said in the 2011 documentary, "Who am I to him? No one knows where I'm at. He doesn't care about me." Her paranoia was more than understandable, especially considering she'd been on a cocaine and alcohol bender. After one of these trips back to the bedroom, he slipped off his boxers and climbed into bed naked with her. He grabbed her crotch and then rolled her over to face him and gave her a fierce look, a look she says terrified her. She pulled away from him again, and then he rolled over to the side of the bed. She maintains to this day that she thought he was reaching for a gun to kill her. Instead, she grabbed the .40 caliber pistol that Cut had given her from her purse and shot Johnny Allen in the back of the head. The prosecution would put on the state medical examiner, who would testify that Allen's body was in a sleeping position and that it was nearly impossible for him to have intertwined his fingers like they were found beneath his chin if he was reaching for a weapon. Even though experts disagree on how long he may have lived and if it was possible he moved his hands, I do think it's possible Centoya simply misread the situation. From her early teen years, she misjudged and mistrusted people. Later, for a pretrial hearing, she would be assessed by a psychologist who confirmed this problem, that she was unable to read the behavior of others. But even if she did misread the situation, there was another problem with Johnny Allen that to this day the prosecution downplays and outright denies. Despite the fact that a magazine holster with a fully loaded clip was found on the bedside table, the assistant district attorney Jeff Burks insisted Allen was not a danger. And the media didn't help, mostly portraying him as a kindly white real estate agent, with even the Tennessean newspaper running a sympathetic article where a former co-worker of his claimed he was probably trying to help Centoya, that God had put him in her path to make a choice. Yeah, right. A 43-year-old man picks up a teenage prostitute and takes her home out of the goodness of his heart. Never mind the fact that he was found nude, or the car hop's testimony of his lecherous behavior. Centoya's defense team put two women on the stand who painted a very different picture of Johnny Allen than the press or the prosecution would have preferred. First up was a 17-year-old McGavick student named Jessica Snyder, who waited tables at the Old Dinner Bell on Lebanon Pike. She said that Allen was a regular and known to hit on the underage staff to the point that they often argued over who had to take his table. Once, when she drew the short straw, he handed her his business card with a note on the back that read, "You're gorgeous. I'd love to take you out sometime, so let me know." However, Judge Randall Wyatt Jr. found her testimony irrelevant and refused to let the jury hear it. But defense attorneys Rich McGee and Wendy Tucker had an even more compelling witness, one that was so reluctant to testify that she had to be subpoenaed. The woman, who remains anonymous, said that she met Johnny Allen in a Mexican restaurant where she was out with some friends. She said he kept winking at her, so her friends invited him over. When she mentioned she was looking for a new church, he invited her to his, the Lakewood Church of Christ, where he was a youth minister and a Sunday school teacher. Let me say that again. The man trolling for underage prostitutes that night was also a youth minister. Anyway, she said after she went to a few of his Sunday school classes, she agreed to go on a date with him. To be safe, she even had him pick her up at a friend's house. They were supposed to go to the movies, but instead he took her back to his house. Just as with Centoya, he gave her the grand tour, showing off his weapons and expensive TV and stereo equipment. He soon came on to her and tried kissing her, and she pushed him away. But she said, just like Centoya did, that something in his eyes scared her. Quote, After he gave me the look, I can't explain that look, because even today I can still see it. Though she begged him to stop, he didn't. He raped her. When it was over, she asked him to take her back to her friend's house, and he did. Like many victims, she didn't report the rape, saying, "I was too ashamed. I guess I blame myself for it." How often do we hear this, that victims blame themselves for being in the situation? But unlike Centoya, this woman got to know Johnny Allen first, thought she was going on a legitimate date, and even took the precaution of having him pick her up at a friend's house. She had attended his church and his Sunday school class, for crying out loud. Sometimes it's difficult to assess who is a predator. And while Centoya Brown suffers from fetal alcohol syndrome and many other psychological problems which impair her judgment, this young lady does not, and she was still duped. But her testimony was largely unhelpful, because next up, the prosecution played a tape from a recorded phone call between Centoya and Ellenette. It's important to note when this conversation took place. It was after what was probably the most important hearing in Centoya's case, the transfer hearing that took place in November of 2004, when a judge had to decide whether Centoya would be tried as an adult. In the day-long hearing, Dr. William Burnett of Vanderbilt Psychiatric Hospital testified to Centoya's incompetence. He diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder and insisted he did not believe she had legally waived her Miranda rights. Dr. Burnett explained to the judge and later in the documentary that while Centoya understood the literal sense of the wording in the Miranda speech, she did not comprehend what those words meant in practice. For instance, he said she failed a test to see if she understood her right against self-incrimination. She thought that she had to speak with the police and didn't know how much it could later hurt someone in her situation. As for the borderline personality disorder diagnosis, when Centoya was arrested, it only took a week before she was sent to Bolivar, Tennessee, to the Western Mental Health Institute for evaluation. Counselors there also believed she suffered from the disorder, though they were not really allowed to make that diagnosis until a patient is 18 years old. Centoya was violent, irrational, and often had to be sedated and secured with what's known as a 4-point, meaning every limb was tied down. The symptoms are extreme mood swings, impulsivity, and paranoia. The risk factors for this disorder read like the story of Centoya Brown: abandonment in early childhood, poor communication within the family, a disrupted family life, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse. Centoya was abandoned at 6 months old, then kidnapped at 18 months old by her own mother, only to reunite with Ellenette 6 months later. And no one knows what or who she may have been exposed to during those 6 months. She had an alcoholic and abusive father. Even Ellenette, who tried desperately to do right by Centoya, made the mistake of hiding things from her, thinking it was in her best interest, when really it only created mistrust. And there is no question she was physically, emotionally, and sexually abused in her teen years, right up to her arrest for murder. But it didn't matter. The judge was not swayed. It's worth mentioning that though Dr. Burnett testified at this hearing, no evidence was provided that showed the history of abuse and rape Centoya had endured, nor was her family history of mental illness addressed. In the documentary, Me Facing Life, Georgina Mitchell is interviewed extensively. She had been diagnosed as bipolar, manic depressive, suicidal, and had also been raped herself. She also revealed that her own mother told her she was the product of rape. Gina's mother, sister, grandfather had all committed suicide, and all of them had used a gun. I believe Centoya Brown is the textbook example of a combination of nature and nurture defining her life. But the judge heard none of this. Her crimes, in context, were very serious. And juvenile court judge Betty Green ruled that she could be tried as an adult, sealing her fate. The recording I was talking about took place right after this hearing when Ellenette called to check on her despondent daughter. On the phone, Ellenette was explaining to her daughter that she was so worried because it wouldn't be long before she turned 18 and would be transferred to the adult facility. Because they're bigger than me? Centoya asked, and Elinette said yes. She said, Don't worry, Mommy. I'll probably be beat up and get stabbed. Almost everyone that goes to the penitentiary gets stabbed or gets their room set on fire. She quickly changed the subject as a horrified Elinette listened, going on to talk about how the food will be so much better in adult prison. This conversation is an excellent example of Centoya's battered mindset. One minute, she can be fatalistically talking about her own future, and the next, looking forward to better food. Elinette kept at it, saying, I would like for you to have some kind of adult life. That's all I'm saying. Centoya replied, Now you understand why I'm so depressed and do the things I do, because I gotta think about that every day. What? Elinette asked. Centoya replied, naming her own future documentary, Me, Facing Life. Elinette said, Right. Facing life is ignoring these people so you can have a life. At the rate you're going, you won't have a life. Centoya said, I probably won't have a life anyway, Ma. It doesn't matter how I behave. You don't understand what I did. I killed someone. I executed him. This is the line the prosecution honed in on at trial. I executed him. And it is an incredibly damning statement. It is also at odds with her claim that she thought he was reaching for a gun. But I honestly believe both can be true. That she thought he was going to hurt her, so she made the decision to kill him first. She did execute him. She pulled the trigger, and then she ran. But before she ran, she grabbed all the guns in the home. Obviously, this looks bad. But not that bad when you put it in context with her relationship with the pimp known as Cutthroat. She was afraid to return to him empty-handed. She jumped in Johnny Allen's truck and hightailed it back to InTown Suites, only to then be met by a furious Cut who was enraged that she brought the guns in without concealing them. He ordered her to get rid of the truck. She drove it to the Walmart on Hamilton Church Road, and surveillance cameras show her waving down a black SUV for a ride back to the motel. She spent the rest of the night and the next day getting stoned and watching the TV for any reports of the murder. Finally, around 5 p.m., she walked over to a friend's room and asked for a ride. She knew this kid, Richard Reed, from juvie back in Clarksville. She told him that she had shot a man for $50,000, and if he gave her a ride to get the rest of the money, she would split it with him. Obviously, the money was a lie. She just wanted a ride. He took her back to the Walmart where she had left Alan's truck and waited as she climbed in. Centoya said she used Alan's cell phone that was in the truck to call his house. When he didn't answer, she finally hung up and told Reed to take her back. She kept the cell phone, though, and about an hour after getting back, placed the anonymous call to 911. She later said she didn't like the idea of Alan lying there at his house undiscovered. Richard Reed and his roommate, Sam Humphrey, were watching the 10 o'clock news and saw the report of a murder. Stunned, Reed told Humphrey of Centoya's tale. They agreed that it would probably be safer if they left InTown Suites for the night. At around 1:20 a.m., Detectives Robinson and Baltimore met Humphrey at a grocery store off of Smith Springs Road. Sam Humphrey told them everything he knew about Centoya and the murder. By 3 a.m., they were banging on Cutting Centoya's door at InTown. Much of this detail was related at Centoya's trial. However, what was not heard by the jury was the compelling testimony of Dr. Burnett about Centoya's mental illness and history of abuse. Her lawyers chose not to call him. They also chose not to put Centoya on the stand. Their case hinged on her story of self-defense, and yet they didn't let her testify. I have to say, after watching the documentary, Centoya Brown was a well-spoken young woman. There was footage from her at 16 when she was arrested and also from 21 years old when the documentary was shot. I believe she would have made a good witness at her own trial. She was a street kid, but again, well-spoken. And I damn sure believe that her psychological issues should have been at the forefront of her defense. So without knowing of Centoya's past or mental state, is it all that shocking that the jury found her guilty? No. I would have voted the same way. Context is everything. Like the juvenile court judge who transferred her to stand trial as an adult, the jury did not have all of the relevant information. A grown Centoya, in her documentary, lamented the lost time in the relationship with her adoptive mother. She said, "I always felt safe when Mommy and I were alone together. I wish I had let her in." This is sadly so true. She did have the benefit of a caring adoptive mother, but the incident of finding the hidden letters from her real mother at age 10 damaged the relationship so much that Centoya lost her fragile support system. In the documentary, Dr. Burnett was able to give the testimony he should have been able to give at trial. He explained very well about Centoya's fetal alcohol disorders, as well as her borderline personality disorder. He also stressed the nature and nurture elements of her upbringing, highlighting the mental illness that runs in Centoya's biological family and the instability and abuse within her adoptive family. Dr. Burnett said, quote, "She was born with vulnerability, and then at a crucial age, she had two very different caregivers. This created a failure to achieve attachment. The root cause of Centoya's general mistrust of others and the number one factor in many psychiatric disorders, including psychopathy." And watching young Centoya in the documentary is a study in contradiction. She is sophisticated enough to use words like obligation easily in conversation. But when she is questioned about her so-called sex list, which was a list she had made of every man she had sex with, she lacked the basic understanding of consent. She behaved as if it were perfectly natural that some of these encounters were forced. Some were with older men. Some were with her own age. Two were even with cousins. She had shrewdly noted that the men in her life were all about acceptance and admiration. From her father to her pimp, they all demanded this from her while denying her those same values. But Centoya Brown has come a long way in prison. She earned a college degree and is committed to, as she put it, fighting for my freedom and retaining my sanity. At this point, it's going to be a long haul. She is ineligible for parole until she is 69 years old. In 2012, Nashville attorney Charles Bone took on Centoya's case pro bono after watching her documentary. He tried unsuccessfully to get her a new trial based on ineffectual counsel. Citing the fact that Dr. Burnett was not called to the stand nor any doctor testifying to her mental state, and that Centoya herself was denied the right to testify, though she wanted to, her attorneys had strongly advised against it. But there have been huge changes with regards to how juveniles are sentenced in recent years. The change began in 1988 when the Supreme Court ruled that no one under the age of 16 could be executed. Then in 2005, that age was raised to 18. In 2010, the justices ruled in a 5-4 split vote that life sentences for juveniles not convicted of murder were unconstitutional. Supreme Court Judge Anthony Kennedy said in his opinion, "The punishment of life without the possibility of parole is in itself a severe sanction, particularly for a young person." In 2012, the court ruled that mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles violate the Eighth Amendment prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment. However, this ruling will not help Centoya because it only applies to sentences where there is no chance for parole. In Tennessee, there is an automatic review after 51 years. There is hope in all these changes, and there have been many strides in the scientific community that help support this cause. Doctors now understand that in teenagers, the regions of the brain responsible for impulse control and decision-making are not fully developed. Is it fair, then, to hold a 16-year-old to the same standards as an 18-year-old? In the United States, unfortunately, we still legally consider this fair. The U.S., South Africa, and Somalia are the only countries left in the world that still sentence juveniles to life sentences. In Tennessee, our government is also trying to make changes, but so far unsuccessfully. Republican Representative Jeremy Faison introduced a bill in 2016 to the state legislature that would require reviews of life sentences for juveniles after they serve 15 years in prison. The bill was quickly shut down, most fiercely by other Republicans who accused Faison of being soft on crime. D.A. Jeff Burks recently was quoted as saying, There has been a group of people who have wanted to make Miss Brown a victim and a celebrity. She was not trafficked, nor was she a sex slave. It's not fair to the victim and his family that the other side of this case is so seldom heard. Excuse me, sir. What other side? The side of a 43-year-old predator who went trolling for an underage prostitute? Who had a history of targeting not only underage girls, but also of rape? I'm sorry, I find it difficult to muster much sympathy for Johnny Allen. But given Centoya Brown's history, I have a great deal of sympathy for her situation. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out the color of Centoya's skin. Why is it so easy to give the Brock Turners of our country a second chance? Or how about the affluenza teen, Ethan Couch, who only served 2 years for killing 4 people while driving drunk? I even think back to my first episode about the murder of Dr. Rachel Maidens by her husband, Randy. Randy was given a sweetheart deal of second-degree murder, only to serve 25 years after brutally shooting his wife 10 times with 2 different guns. He was 42 years old at the time. Remember, Mr. Maidens was also in the Nashville criminal court system. All 3 are rich white men, and yet Centoya Brown, a 16-year-old mixed-race girl, was given a life sentence for turning the gun on Johnny Allen, a man with a history of predatory behavior. Our country's handling of juvenile defendants is deplorable, but it's not the only problem. The systemic racism in our courts has long incarcerated persons of color at the rate of more than 5 times that of white people. And in America, it's pretty obvious that you get the justice you can afford. I believe we still have a long way to go to rectify how color, age, and poverty affect the quality of justice in this country. Until then, we have to keep speaking out for the Centoya Browns and against the Brock Turners. Because if we don't demand change, who will? I'd like to give a big thank you to listener Stacy Rockwood for suggesting Centoya's case. I told her at the time that I thought a bunch of podcasts would be covering it due to the national attention Rihanna's post garnered, but as of yet, I haven't heard one. I'm hoping others do pick up the story and keep the momentum going. Centoya is one of thousands in this country, a veritable sea of children that we have essentially thrown away. And I would also like to send a special thank you to iTunes reviewer Kate530. I usually don't mention reviews on the show, it's just something I feel kind of sheepish doing. But sometimes, a listener will leave a review that really touches me. And Kate, I just wanted to say you were right, and thank you so much for your support. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. If you like the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I know iTunes doesn't make it easy for you, but it is still the best way for others to find Southern Fried, so I really appreciate your help. I am also on Stitcher and many other apps like Auto Radio, Overcast, and Pocket Casts. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to patreon.com/southernfriedtruecrime. I have different rewards for each level of donation. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Southern Fried True Crime if you'd like to connect with me there. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, y'all take care.